DW Deutsche Welle. World in Progress.
Hello and welcome to World in Progress. I'm Sarah Steffen. This week, we'll talk about the Rohingya Muslim minority in Myanmar, a country formerly known as Burma. More than 500,000 Rohingya have fled to neighboring Bangladesh over the last weeks after a military crackdown.
I was hiding, but I saw how my son tried to escape. There were so many soldiers. They threw him to the floor and then into the fire.
The Muslims are aggressive. They want the whole Rakhine state for themselves. They want to occupy all of Myanmar.
We can't expect the Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi to help us. What we want is to wake our rulers from their slumber and get serious about Rohingya issues in Myanmar.
She can't actually do anything directly about the crisis. She could contradict what's happening. She could denounce what's happening. I suspect, from what one knows of the Burmese military, they wouldn't smile on that. And within that constitution, they possess the right to close down the civilian government completely and revert to junta rule.
We hear from Rohingya who have fled to Bangladesh. And we also hear from a reporter who went out to see what the situation is like in Rakhine State at the moment, but was significantly impaired from actually doing any reporting. All that and more coming up now, so stay tuned. The Rohingya in Myanmar have faced decades of persecution and discrimination. The Buddhist majority nation denies most Rohingya citizenship, even though their families have lived in the country for generations. The most recent outburst of violence is said to have started when a Rohingya insurgent group launched deadly attacks on security posts at the end of August. The military then destroyed entire villages as part of a military crackdown.
The situation has spiraled into the world's fastest developing refugee emergency and a humanitarian and human rights nightmare.
That's UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
We have received bone-chilling accounts from those who fled, mainly women, children, and the elderly. These testimonies point to excessive violence and serious violations of human rights, including indiscriminate firing of weapons, the presence of landmines, and sexual violence. This is unacceptable and must end immediately.
He warned violence could spread even further as Myanmar fails to address systematic violence.
We should not be surprised if decades of discrimination and double standards in treatment of the Rohingya create openings for radicalization.
Rohingya have been pushed to live in ghetto-like camps since violence broke out in 2012. Nikki Haley, U.S. ambassador to the UN, urged countries to stop supplying weapons to Myanmar, calling the atrocities, quote-unquote, ethnic cleansing.
We cannot be afraid to call the actions of the Burmese authorities what they appear to be: a brutal, sustained campaign to cleanse the country of an ethnic minority. And it should shame senior Burmese leaders who have sacrificed so much for an open, democratic Burma.
Myanmar's government has denied allegations of ethnic cleansing. That's what Myanmar's National Security Advisor Thong Thuen stressed in front of the UN.
I wish to stress there is no ethnic cleansing and no genocide in Myanmar. Ethnic cleansing and genocide are serious charges, and they should not be used lightly.
Meanwhile, authorities in Bangladesh have reported that up to 5,000 Rohingya continue to cross the border every day, as security forces redouble efforts to drive the remaining Rohingya from their villages. Despite reassurances from local officials, the army reportedly ordered them to leave, eyewitnesses said. Silke Dietrich went to Bangladesh to talk to Rohingya who had fled across the border. Her report is presented by Charlotte Lomas.
The twin babies were born just 4 days ago in the mud. Their mother, Rokeya Begum, is huddling under a plastic tarp and gently cradles a tiny naked baby. His twin brother is lying next to her on a ragged blanket. Rokeya's mother-in-law helped her deliver the babies. It was hard, Rakia says. She's been exhausted ever since before the birth because she had to flee for days through the forest. She explains she was afraid of the soldiers in Myanmar.
They killed my father. They harassed the women and there was fire everywhere.
More than 35,000 babies are among the refugees stranded in Bangladesh, according to UNICEF. Some 10,000 women are pregnant. Some were able to flee before the soldiers came to their villages. Others have horrible stories to tell, like 35-year-old Hasina.
I was hiding, but I saw how my son tried to escape. There were so many soldiers. They threw him to the floor and then into the fire.
Hasina has four children, she says. One is dead now. Another is with her in Bangladesh. She doesn't know where her other two sons and her husband are. So far, she hasn't had time to mourn. For the refugees in Bangladesh, it's all about survival. Many aid organisations as well as political groups have collected donations. Trucks are hardly getting through to the crowded streets. Refugees try to get some of what they can carry, food, clean water, a few clothes. Mosadeka is 10 and carries a heavy sack of rice. She hardly dares to put it down. At home in Myanmar, the family owned a house where she and her six siblings, seven cows, four goats and a few chickens lived. That was until the soldiers came. They shot one of her sisters, she says.
I was so afraid. They cut up people. I ran away with my father.
Now many are afraid they are not safe here either. Not because they are being persecuted, but because so many have come at the same time. There are not enough toilets and clean water for everyone. And aid organisations fear the fragile are already getting sick. Those with severe injuries have been taken to several hospitals in southern Bangladesh.
I can't see anything. I lost my eyes.
That's Yusuf Nobi. He's lying in a dirty hallway in the state hospital in Chittagong in southern Bangladesh. He hears the moans of the many other patients around him. There are many lying on straw mats and mattresses. Yusuf is in great pain. His legs are covered in bandages. The young farmer lost both feet when a mine went off.
It was a mine. There was an explosion below me. Then the muscles from my legs were hanging out.
Yusuf fled his village because there was fire everywhere, he says in a low voice. He was on the road for days until he had almost reached the border. He could already see Bangladesh, and then he hit the landmine.
I just took a normal step forward, then something below me blew up.
The hospital is hopelessly flooded. More than 2,000 patients are here now, even though the Medical College Hospital only has beds for half that number. There are bloodstains on the stairs and a stench of urine, sweat and disinfectant. Not far from Yusuf, Naubab Sharif is lying on a mat. He raises his arms and spreads his fingers. His skin is torn to pieces.
The army surrounded our village. Then they imposed a curfew from 6 at night to 6 in the morning. They must have put landmines around our village then, but we did not know that.
There is an international agreement prohibiting landmines, but Myanmar did not sign this treaty. It's not just the refugees who talk about landmines in Myanmar. The government of Bangladesh has protested landmines so close to their borders. They claim there are photos that prove the existence of these mines. Myanmar's military claims that the army is not placing new landmines. They say the mines are from the 1990s and the soldiers were trying to remove them. Several hours on a dusty road and you've reached the Memorial Christian Hospital on Cox's Bazaar. It has taken in people who stepped on landmines. The hospital had to put up an additional tent because several Rohingya with multiple injuries were brought here. Tasman Ara came with her father. The 10-year-old can hardly remember fleeing Myanmar because she was unconscious.
My whole face hurts, behind my eye and on my nose.
She can't see anything anymore in that eye, she says.
I was playing outside during the day and all of a sudden a bullet hit me in my eye. I don't know who fired that shot. People say it was the police.
She doesn't recall what happened next. Her father gently touches her arm. He carried her all the way to Bangladesh. She was bleeding from the eye. A tear runs down Tasman's cheek. She can't blink anymore. Many refugees still live outside in the camps, as many temporary tents have not been able to withstand the heavy rain at night. Some 300 refugees are without shelter, says Habib Ahmad.
We ran up a hill in the middle of the night. Some had an umbrella, others just sat in the rain. Some could save a few things, but most of it was just washed away by the rain.
The government has deployed more and more police to organise aid. They want to clear some 800 hectares of forest to build new refugee camps. It's not going to work out for long, says MP Mayeen Badal, who has come with other party members to hand out food and clothes in the new camps.
How long Bangladesh can show this humanity? It is already skin deep. We cannot take it anymore. Come up with a safe zone in Myanmar under the UN flagship. Otherwise, you cannot save this.
Bangladesh is only half the size of Germany, but has twice as many people. It's one of the most densely populated countries in the world. Refugees from Myanmar have no other choice but to flee there. Rukia, the mother of the twins, says she only sees a future for her children here in Bangladesh, even though they sleep under a tarpaulin. Hasina, the woman who says her son was burnt by soldiers in Myanmar, wants to stay here too. She says she has nowhere else to go.
We don't have anything here. We don't even have tears left to cry.
Charlotte Lomas with a report by Silke Dietrich. You're listening to DW's World in Progress with a special on the Rohingya crisis in Myanmar and its neighboring countries. You can find more of our coverage online at dw.com and on our Facebook page, Global Society. Myanmar's authorities have denied charges of ethnic cleansing and have instead accused the Rohingya people of looting their own homes. At the same time, Myanmar makes it near to impossible to obtain first-hand information in the country because journalists are barely given any access. That was a problem Lena Bodewijn faced when she went into Myanmar in an attempt to report on the situation. Her report is presented by Anke Raspa.
A Buddhist monastery in Sitwe, the capital of Rakhine State. We're about 100 kilometers or 60 miles away from the area where Muslim villages are burning. That's as close as the authorities permit the German journalists from the ARD team to get to the conflict. The abbot here recites prayers. Young novices play hide and seek. Chicken and dogs run around in the courtyard. And there are many Buddhist families who have fled the violence. Many are in fear, the abbot says.
The Muslims are aggressive. They want the whole Rakhine state for themselves. They want to occupy all of Myanmar.
But if the Buddhists fear the Muslims, why have some 500,000 Rohingya fled Myanmar? Why do they claim that Myanmar's army forces Muslims out of the country in a wave of ethnic cleansing?
The Muslims act as victims. International media misrepresent the situation. Our military does the right thing.
The problem is that Myanmar doesn't allow independent observers to enter the crisis region. There were some media tours for carefully selected journalists. They were introduced to Buddhists who told them about their fear of Rohingya extremists. But on one of these tours, BBC reporter Jonathan Head saw members of the Buddhist population put fire to houses with the help of police, the villagers said.
We bumped into the people who almost certainly lit them, carrying machetes, not wanting to talk. Though one did admit, yes, they'd set these buildings alight with the help of the police, the ethnic Rakhine.
Since then, the tours have been cancelled because such observations compromised the official version told by the military that claims that Muslim villagers torched their own buildings to obstruct security forces and come across as victims. Muslims who've made it across the border to Bangladesh say this is not true. Like this young man, who says that their houses were torched by police. He says what they used to call home is now gone. All they could save was their own lives.
It took us 8 days to get over the mountains and through the jungle. 8 days to get here. We didn't have anything to eat, apart from a bit of rice for the children. We couldn't cook anything while we were on our way. There was so much suffering.
Those who have fled tell of husbands who have been shot, women who have been raped, and children who were thrown into fires. No one can check whether these stories are true, but everyone can see the desperation in the faces of these refugees and their huge number. Almost 500,000 people are now in temporary shelters in Bangladesh, living under horrible conditions. But why? Who is to blame? And what is the truth? Getting to the bottom of things is very difficult, if not impossible, as the ARD team experienced firsthand. Waiting to fill out forms, waiting for signatures, waiting for stamps, another government agency and another and yet another government official. And then finally the TV and radio team gets the travel authorization to visit a camp where many thousand Rohingya live. For their own protection, the authorities say. The Rohingya live amid dust, heat and dire poverty in Myanmar, a country that is very poor anyway. But soon the first driver called it quits. He fears people could see how the TV team he's transporting also films in close proximity to a mosque. A mosque. That means Muslim and thus pro-Rohingya, which automatically translates to anti-Buddhist and against the majority of the population. That's how the reasoning here goes. The second driver does continue towards the camp, but then, just in front of the gate, we're told we allegedly have the wrong form or the wrong signature or was signed by the wrong authorities. We can't enter the camp. It's impossible to find the truth this way. So it's back to the small town of Sitwe. We ask people at hawker stalls why the conflict exists, who's at fault and what should be done. And then suddenly a person with authority shows up.
Better stop right there. The international media always favors Muslims when they write about the conflict. That angers the local population.
More and more people come and agree with the man. So we eventually pack up and go elsewhere. We come across offices of the International Committee of the Red Cross, but they are deserted. The staff work from home because they fear they could become targets of violence at the Red Cross premises. One Red Cross aid parcel was reportedly found in a camp of Rohingya rebels. Immediately, people claimed that the Red Cross was supporting terrorists. That's the reason why the Buddhist monastery in Sitwe doesn't accept donations from the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, or from the World Food Programme. The international aid organizations are said to favor the Rohingya, and people also say the international press is biased in their reporting. It's a conflict with manipulated truths on both sides. Buddhists claim the Rohingya are setting their own villages on fire. The Rohingya and their supporters post pictures of misery and hardship on social media that were recorded several years ago, or even shot in completely different countries. That's also what the Turkish vice president recently did. And since Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan spoke out in favor of the prosecuted Muslims, people in Myanmar hate Turks. The German broadcasting team also experienced this kind of hatred, as you can see in a video posted on Facebook. The cameraman, a technician, a correspondent and the local translator were cornered, beset and questioned. Who are you? We've seen you before. The video's subtitles on Facebook say two Turks and a white woman are filming propaganda for the Rohingya. Nothing about this statement is true, except the skin color of the journalist. But the situation that gets out of hand very quickly is very real. More and more people join in, the police arrives and helps the team get to the hotel safely. The crowd gets bigger and follows the team, people get louder. The police guard the hotel entrance. Angry people have posted videos of that on Facebook too. They've been shared and commented thousands of times.
Don't let them in. Hit the translator. Kill them if they are Turks.
Where does this hatred come from? Why the eruption of violence now? Critical journalists in Myanmar privately say the military has been provoking this violence in order to undermine Aung San Suu Kyi's party. If that's the truth, it's a bitter truth. Is there no hope? Peter Popham, who's written a biography of Aung San Suu Kyi, says it's difficult to say.
As I see it, she's stuck. She agreed to go into politics in 2011, 1 year after being released from house arrest. And the conditions by which she was allowed to go in were that she accepted the constitution, which the military had forced through in 2008. And that constitution, which is still in force today, gives the military exclusive right to control defence affairs, border affairs, home affairs, all of the affairs which relate to what's happening in Rakhine State. So she can't actually do anything directly about the crisis. She could contradict what's happening, she could denounce what's happening. I suspect, from what one knows of the Burmese military, they wouldn't smile on that. And within that constitution, they possess the right to close down the civilian government completely and revert to junta rule.
1.1 million Rohingya used to live in Myanmar. Some 500,000 of them have left the country in the past few weeks. If Aung San Suu Kyi takes too much time with finding steps to resolve this crisis, there might be no Rohingya left in Myanmar. And that is the truth.
Anke Raspa there with a report by Lena Bodewein. Rohingya have also fled to neighboring Pakistan since the 1960s. The recent wave of violence against Rohingya in Myanmar upsets many there, and especially the younger generation. Those who were born in Pakistan are angry about the plight of the Rohingya in Myanmar. And as Mudassar Shah reports, they could become radicalized to quote-unquote take revenge. Emma Wallace has this report.
It's a sunny day in Karachi, the financial capital of Pakistan. Dozens of school and college students, both girls and boys, are busy demonstrating, shouting, "Save the children" and "Stop Muslim genocide in Myanmar." A local organization, the Anwar Habib Foundation, is a Pakistani religious not-for-profit organization. It organized the protest. Alama Saida Habib, the founder of the Anwar Habib Foundation in Karachi, says the aim of the protest is to put pressure on the government to speak up for the Rohingya community in Myanmar.
It feels like Muslim genocide is becoming written into some parts of international policy. I feel like our rulers are just asleep and don't care about what is going on. In my opinion, every sane person should understand this point, but people here seem to be busy just enjoying the routine of their lives, eating, sleeping, and working. We can't expect the Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi to help us. What we want is to wake our rulers from their slumber and get serious about Rohingya issues in Myanmar.
Not all of the protesters come from the Rohingya community, although they are staging it where the majority of Rohingyas in Karachi live, in the Arkan Abad colony. There are many young women protesting, who believe that because most Pakistanis share a religion with the Rohingyas, it is their duty to stand up and protest on their behalf. there's a strong smell spreading across the slums of Arkan Abad. It is the smell of dried shrimps, which fishermen have brought from the coast nearby. It's usual here for 10 to 15 families to share one water tap. Malnutrition and diarrhea are common amongst children here. The black smoke from nearby factories disguises the real color of the sky. Women and girls are confined to houses and follow strict religious edicts, covering their entire bodies and faces in an abaya, a type of burqa. Hardly any of the houses have a door because no one possesses anything worth stealing. The Pakistani government has criticized the Myanmar government for its offensive, but so far its actions have stopped there. Many of the Rohingya in Pakistan don't have official permits, despite contributing to the economy through their fishing activities. The only way for many Rohingya to get identity cards in Pakistan is to first declare themselves as Bangladeshis and then claim a Pakistani registration with their Bangladeshi status, which is easier. That is what 21-year-old Arman Fida hopes to do, but it's difficult, he explains.
The officials demand $400 for a national identity card. I earn $250 a month, so how can I pay them that much amount? It would take me 6 or 7 months to pay the loan I'd borrowed from someone. It's a difficult deal for a poor person like me.
Amongst the young Rohingyas, there is growing dissatisfaction with the Pakistani authorities. Wali Muhammad is 21. He has been unemployed for the last few months. He meets up with other jobless friends in the evenings.
I left school when I was 15 to support the family. The only option open to me was to go to the sea to fish. But now the coast guards check identity cards, which we don't have. So I've been deprived of my livelihood. Lots of us don't have access to the same facilities which Pakistanis have.
One of Wali's friends turns on a video on his cell phone.
I weep for a long time when I watch these kinds of videos. One which stuck in my mind was of a girl who was stripped naked and then raped by 10 to 15 people. Later she was tied up with rope and burnt alive.
Because of the problem with getting identity cards, most members of the Rohingya community have remained poor. Even when they have a job, they are only entitled to half the daily wages Pakistanis can expect because of their lack of a legal work permit.
We, the Rohingya, are being killed by Buddhists there in Myanmar, whereas Pakistanis kill us daily here in Pakistan. The Buddhists kill us once by shedding our blood, whereas Pakistanis kill us in installments bit by bit. This is the only difference.
It is midnight in Arkan Abad colony, but the jobless young men are still awake and angry. One of Wali's friends starts singing a song, inciting other young men to take up arms. The song says that young Rohingya men should go to Myanmar for jihad, and with the mercy of God, they should take revenge for their relatives. The song declares, "We, the young Rohingya, will take back our land and rule there once again." So far, the Pakistani authorities have not acknowledged this growing dissatisfaction. The danger now is that other radical groups will capitalize upon the young men's anger and recruit them to fight jihad around the world. The Rohingya community in Pakistan may not be its largest minority group, but their anger, stoked up by watching brutal videos, is a ticking time bomb, which could explode at any time.
Emma Wallace with that report by Mudassar Shah. And I'm afraid that's all we have time for today on World in Progress. If you'd like to listen to this or past episodes again, just go to dw.com/worldinprogress or find us on iTunes or SoundCloud. Thanks very much for tuning in. From all of us in the studio, Iliana Gagliarducci and Gerd Georgi, I'm Sarah Steffen, and this was World in Progress. Bye for now.